Let's hear it one more time for that choir. Good morning, North Bay UUs. I want to dedicate this sermon to the Reverend Jack Mendelson, who died Thursday at age 94. Jack Mendelson, a Unitarian Universalist giant, eloquent preacher, great scholar of William Ellery Channing, author of Why I Am a Unitarian Universalist, mentor to so many of us during his 59 years of ministry, and most of all, a passionate, ferocious, indefatigable advocate for social justice. Blessings on Jack Mendelson. My favorite stories is of the young Unitarian Universalist boy who was engaged to be married to a British girl who had grown up in high church Anglicanism. And in order to acquaint her fiancé with the intricacies of an Anglican service, the young woman took her boyfriend one Sunday morning to Christ Church Cathedral in Oxford. And throughout the service, the young man was kneeling and leaping up and chanting and reading from the Book of Common Prayer until finally, sweating and exhausted, he took out his handkerchief, wiped his brow, and laid his handkerchief on his lap to dry. And when she saw this, the young woman leaned over to him and she whispered, "Darling, darling, is your fly open?" To which the startled young man replied, "No, no, should it be?" Now, each of our Unitarian Universalist worship services in each of our congregations has its liturgical quirks. None of them, with the possible exception of King's Chapel in Boston, are as complicated as that poor young man encountered at Oxford. And that is why it is easy for this great gathering to come together this morning from all over the Bay Area under one banner, one liturgy, to celebrate one faith, a faith that is grounded in the theme of this revival and indeed the title of my sermon, Hope? Hell yes. Now, I'm interested in the subject of hope for two reasons. First, because I'm often tempted, as I expect so many of us are, to have so little of it. I think it's appropriate, given where we are in this country, to say that I sometimes feel like Charlie Brown did when Lucy once said to him, "Charlie Brown, in the great cruise ship of life, some people place their deck chairs to the fore and look at what's coming, and others place their deck chairs to the aft and look at what's past. In the great cruise ship of life, Charlie Brown, which way is your deck chair facing?" And Charlie Brown replied, "In the great cruise ship of life, I'm one of those who can't get my deck chair unfolded." But I'm also interested in hope because I am sometimes, against all odds, so filled with it. When I was at Amnesty International, the question I was asked repeatedly for 12 years was simply this: given all the horror and carnage that you encounter in your work, torture, rape, murder, how do you retain any sense of optimism, of hope about human nature and the human future? But you know, I did. And I do. I sometimes felt guilty about feeling hopeful when everyone else looked so glum, but I often did feel hopeful, and still I often do. So let me tell you why. And I want to begin by acknowledging very directly the case against hope. The truth is that the world is full of endless folly and enervating evil. I don't think I have to convince you of that or even give you examples. The human race may well render the planet uninhabitable. Human beings harm each other grievously. Hope does not always win. Justice does not always prevail. But when we consider the larger shape of history, the broader human enterprise, I think there is a 60-40 case to be made for hope. for the possibility that the human spirit is not inevitably tainted by ignorance and ignominy.
Amen. Amen.
One reason has to do with the nature of power and social change, and two others have to do with the characteristics of being human. I was ordained 37 years ago, and what Cardinal John Patrick Foley's mother said of him might well be said of me. Cardinal Foley grew up in Connecticut, but he was for many years the chief spokesperson for the Vatican, and he was a connoisseur of Italian food. And when he returned to the United States after several years in Rome, his mother took one look at him and said, "John, there were 20 pounds of you that were not ordained." I'm not interested in that kind of change. I'm interested in how the world has changed in 37 years. In 1975, about a third of the countries in the world were democratic, about a third. Today, more than three quarters of the world's countries are democracies. In the first 75 years of the 20th century, only four women had served as heads of state in human history. Since then, there have been 41 more. In 1975, there was no way to bring to justice any of the world's great tyrants and dictators. A few months ago, the International Criminal Court convicted its first defendant. In 1975, Burma was under vicious military rule. No one had heard of Aung San Suu Kyi. And 3 weeks ago, the mother of Burmese democracy took a triumphant tour of the United States. In 1975, it would have been impossible to imagine a world without the Soviet Union. Impossible to imagine a world without an apartheid South Africa or a battle-scarred Northern Ireland. Impossible, impossible to imagine the United States with an African-American president. How did these things, and many others I could mention, how did they change and change for the better? When I was in graduate school, I wore these pants. I hope you can see them. I wore these paisley pants every day for 4 years without a pair. They have been washed since then. And I was the envy of the University of Chicago campus. But why is it that not a single graduate student in the United States would be caught dead wearing pants like these today? It is simply because fashion norms change, and as norms change, so does the configuration of power. And over the past 37 years, indeed since the end of World War II, we have seen a radical shift in global norms, a shift in the direction of greater openness to diverse voices, of a more equitable distribution of power, and contrary to everything we think we know intuitively, when measured statistically, we have seen a significant reduction in violence. Now, of course, it's true that global poverty remains stubbornly unmitigated, that Israelis and Palestinians still haunt each other's dreams, that corporate profits still favor the 1%, because as my favorite protest sign of the Occupy movement put it, nobody with four aces asks the dealer to deal again. But if we follow the advice of one of the greatest philosophers of all time, Baruch Spinoza, who said in effect, always take the view from eternity. If we take the long view, if we consider that just 250 years ago, virtually no one opposed slavery. No one opposed racist taunts. No one opposed the subjugation of women, and today no reputable person would openly and publicly defend any of them. If we take this perspective, if we look at human history, not in Aldous Huxley's famous phrase as one damn thing after another, but if we see it in its totality, it is impossible to argue credibly that on balance humankind has not made enormous progress. Now, could the human race regress? Absolutely. We all may go back to wearing turquoise paisley pants. No, I hear you shout. Is progress guaranteed? Absolutely not. History is not fated or determined to move in any particular direction, good or bad, but thus far, and on balance, the shift in norms and hence in power has been largely in a progressive direction. The radical journalist I.F. Stone put it this way: the only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you are going to lose, because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until the day when somebody who believes as you do finally wins. And when we look at history, I think the odds in favor of hope are at least 60-40. But perhaps this is a bit too esoteric to be of real comfort, so let me offer you two more practical reasons for hope in the human enterprise, both of which emerge from my observations of human beings. The first is an observation about human resilience. When the British began trying in earnest to climb Mount Everest, the Tibetans who served as their porters were dumbfounded. Tibetans have no word for the summit of the mountain. And when they saw the great sacrifices the British were making, losing limbs to frostbite, losing their lives to falls, one of their high lamas said, "I felt great compassion for them to suffer so much for such meaningless work." But one of the great privileges of my life has been to come to know so many people who suffered so much for such important work. What has always astonished me about those I have known who were victims of human rights abuses was that if they survived the death threats or the years of unjust imprisonment or torture, it was because they never gave up. They endured suffering greater than you and I could ever imagine. They sustained deep wounds, often scarred for life emotionally and physically. But time after time, they were prepared to re-engage in the struggle for justice. What stubbornness, what devotion does it take to have your two little girls kidnapped by Guatemalan death squads, then murdered? To not be able to speak of them for 20 years without tears, but to then become an outspoken advocate for other people's human rights. That's the story of one of my most effective staff members at Amnesty International. Nick Yaris spent 23 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. And when he was released and was asked how he felt, he said, "What are my choices? I could be really devastated and angry and let them continue to own me, or I could have fun." Having fun sounds better. The lowest insult would be if I came out destroyed, a broken man, a bad man. My survival technique was to become a good man. Perez Aguirre was tortured mercilessly in a South American prison, and many years later, walking along the street, he ran into the very man who had tortured him. The torturer was now among those being prosecuted, and he tried to avoid Aguirre's gaze, but Aguirre took the initiative. "How are you?" he asked the torturer. The man said he was very depressed. There was a long pause, and then Perez Aguirre said, "If you need anything, come to see me." And then he said, "Shake hands, friend. I forgive you." The resilience of the human spirit is so profound that I would be guilty of the worst form of narcissism if I gave up hope in human transformation when so many others who have seen humanity at its worst have managed not to. But of course, heroes and heroines like that are very rare. Few of us display that kind of resilience in the face of agony. But what large numbers of us are capable of feeling is simply another person's pain. If resilience is unusual, generosity is commonplace. A few months after the horrendous genocide in Rwanda in 1994, a team of so-called reconciliation experts went to that tattered country to help the Tutsis, 800,000 of whom had just been slaughtered by members of the Hutu tribe, to help the Tutsis begin the process of healing and forgiveness. And for several hours, the experts conducted their training, inviting members of the village from different tribes to share their feelings with one another. But finally, one of the village elders said, "You know, all this is good, but what we really need in this village is a bus." The reconciliation experts were taken aback. "Yes," they said, "perhaps the village does need a bus, but we're here to talk about far more serious things than that." But the elder persisted. "We need a bus," he said. And soon all the villagers were chanting, "A bus, a bus, a bus." And finally, one of the women in the group explained, "We need a bus," she said. "We need a bus that will start its route in the Hutu part of the region, and then drive to the Pygmy part, and then to the Tutsi part, and then back again. And we want to design the seats of the bus so that all seats face one another. And we want to have a rule that no one may sit beside a person from their own tribe. And we want to have conductors who one day are Hutu, and the next day are Pygmy, and the next day are Tutsi. And by the way, we want all the conductors to be women." There are many reasons I became president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, but the most important one is because UUSC makes it so easy for every one of us to be generous of heart, and to stand side by side with the less fortunate, and to be innovative, and to be nimble, and to do all that for a very modest amount of money. I'm going to give you just one example. A few months ago, I traveled to Aung San Suu Kyi's Burma, what is now known as Myanmar. When I was at Amnesty, I wouldn't have been allowed into Burma, but this time I received a visa at the airport on my arrival. I drove 4 hours northeast of Mandalay into villages so remote that one of them had never even seen a foreigner. I went there because 3 years ago, UUSC started 12 credit unions in collaboration with a network of Buddhist monasteries. Before that happened, the villagers paid 25% to a middleman when they needed to borrow money. But now each week, the women of the village go to the monastery, they deposit their dollar or their $1.50 into the credit union, and they earn 4% interest. Some of you may want to consider shifting your investment. And today, there are 300 villages being served by UUSC credit unions. And you know what? Now that Burma is becoming more open politically, those credit unions are becoming centers for political organizing. One village, for example, got sick of the military coming in and stealing their sand. So the credit union wrote a letter to the local paper, and astonishingly, seeing the village united, the military stopped stealing the sand. UUSC is channeling your generous hearts to 22 countries and all over the United States, bringing potable water, as you know, to Central California, stopping female genital mutilation in Sudan, exposing poultry companies that steal the wages of their undocumented workers in Arkansas. Hope? Hell yes! No one can understand what UUSC is doing and not feel hope in the human future. Yes, I know. Many of those who commit the most horrible crimes suffer no remorse. Believe me, I know that. I think it was Heinrich Himmler who said it was just a ghastly thing we had to do, killing people every day and then going home to our children. A terrible tragedy for us. We're the ones you should feel sorry for. Yes, I am. But far, far more people are touched by the sight of the injured, moved by the fate of the fallen, and prepared, when our leaders be wise and our laws be just, to extend their hands to the helpless and their hearts to the hopeless. And we need not be among those hopeless, my friends, for the sweep of history carries promise of our redemption. Powered as it is, sustained as it is, by both resilience and compassion. Those are the reasons for hope. Faithful, relentless, undaunted, courageous. That's why I've chosen not to give up on the human project. What we need is a bus. 60-40 may not be the best odds in the world, but when you consider what we're up against, I'll take them any day. Faithful, relentless, undaunted, courageous. Bet on hope, my friend. The odds are in our favor. I'll take them any day, and together we can make them even better. Amen. Let the congregation say amen. Amen. Amen.